Howie W., welcoming his wife, Jessie. They're from Innisfail, Alberta.
I brought my own bottle in case you people haven't got any. You know, today is St. Patrick's Day, in case you people don't know it. Nobody has said anything about it, except this morning, and that was a lady that said that. So I'm going to start out. Did you know that St. Patrick was the first member of AA in Ireland? Now just think about that for a minute. He got rid of all the snakes. And I've had a few of those snakes, and I know what they're like. And I'm awful glad for St. Patrick. And in that same line, there's a tale goes around about little Patrick. Patrick was an awful drunk. And this was before AA. And Patrick finally died of the drink. And they laid him out in the living room, and the mother was bringing the people through to see them, and the first one guests arrived, and they said, "Oh, poor Patrick, poor Patrick. What did he die of?" And she said, "Gonorrhea." And everybody kind of ducked and walked away, and finally one of the sons come over and said, "Mother, mother, why are you telling everybody Dad died of that terrible disease when you know he died of diarrhea?" And she said, "Far better than they think he went out as a sport than the shit he really was." And that's what started it. Now, you'll have to excuse my French, but that's the only one I know. So I'm sorry about that. My name is Howie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm old, and I'm on oxygen, and I don't really care. How's that? I'm pleased about it. Anybody that can make it this far in life has got to be pleased about it, because God's been good to you, and don't ever forget it. He has really leaned us out there and said, "Howard, I'm going to put you through some stuff, but somebody's going to carry you." And it's been the organization of AA and the fellowship of AA that has carried me through. And with a lot of prayers from a lot of people in AA, I've gone through quite a bit. And I'm not the least bit sorry about it. In fact, I'm grateful. I was born and raised in a little town in Alberta called Innisfail. And I'm going to tell you a bit about that story because I think it's important. When the war broke out, the Second World War, that is, in case you people don't remember, we had one, you know. I was 10 years old. And I remember I delivered the telegrams to my father that said, "Report for duty, war has broken out." And I never saw him again for 6 years after he left in the Army. And by the time he came home, of course, I'm 16, 17, and I'm well into my cups by then. And I remember the first night that they got home, I got stinking drunk. And the amazing part about it, my mother used to get really upset, and Dad never did, because he just knew, "Well, it's another soldier," he said, you know. And my mother was, she used to get upset about it, but nobody really said anything. But I knew from the day that I took a drink that I didn't handle it the same way as other people. I just didn't. Every time I ever took a drink in my life, I wanted another one. And there was nothing I could do about it. Now, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the medical side of it really explains that. It says you can't look at alcoholism without looking at the physical side of it. And I believe I was truly allergic to alcohol. And in fact, when I was 21 years old, I was thrown Christmas Day in Halifax, I was thrown in a hospital, the Navy hospital, and they had me all wired up, and my heart was pounding so bad that I thought I was gone. And the doctor told me a couple of days later, when they got me settled down, shot full of vitamin B and all that good stuff. He said, young man, I think that you're allergic to alcohol and you should never drink. It's dangerous. So, like the typical alcoholic that I was, I didn't drink for 2 weeks. I really didn't. And I thought I had cured. This guy told me I shouldn't drink, I won't drink. And then I decided that my problem was not what I was drinking, it was the people I was drinking with. I had to get away from them. So I got away from all my friends in Halifax. I got moved to the West Coast. And that's where I wanted to go in the first place. So, and I got on the train, and the boys had provided me with a whole little attaché case full of rum and a few other drinks. And I got on the train, and I was drunk before we left the station. And I got into more trouble on that bloody train than you'll ever believe. This, let me tell you a few of, this tells you the character of me when I'm on a drunk. I got drunk before I left the station, and then I met a girl, and I had all this rum. She liked rum. We got in her bunk. I got thrown out of her bunk. And the next thing I know, I woke up and I'm in the sleeping parlor, or the smoking parlor, rather, and there's a big black man there that's the porter, and he's saying, man, you're in trouble. You're in trouble. And I said, what did I do? And I said, where are my clothes? And I was in shorts. And he said, you passed out in the smoking room last night, and I threw you in your bunk, and I took all your clothes because I thought you might get sick, and you did. And I got sick all over the girl down below me. But then I ran down the aisle to make it to the smoker's room, and he said, some old lady stuck her head out and screamed because I had no clothes on, and you're in trouble. And you know, by the time we hit Montreal, I figured I was going to jail for sure. And I talked the girl that I got sick on into me paying for a dry cleaning. And I forgot to tell you, it was her wedding dress I got sick on. She was going to get married. I know this sounds like a sailor's tale, but it's not. It's the truth. And I talked my way out of it as I normally could. And I got off in Montreal and got drunk for 3 days and rode the rest of the way to Alberta without any meals or any food because I was broke. And they say when you spend like a drunken sailor, it don't take long. You don't take long at all to not have a nickel. Because when you're making $46 a month, you don't get drunk too long. And I stayed in the Navy for 28 years. And I didn't think I'd ever get over it. I was single then, and I didn't really give a damn. And I got back, and I got promoted. That's another thing I could never understand. They promoted me to petty officer, and I was back on the West Coast. And the first night that I slept in the single men's quarters, I set my sleeve on fire on my pajamas. The mattress caught on fire and a few other things. And you know, I got up just as smooth as could be. I put the fire out with a bucket of water, and I moved the mattress onto somebody else's bunk, and I went in and I went to sleep, and that was it. And I escaped like that a lot. And then the Korean War broke out, and they were talking about posting me. In fact, I was supposed to leave the next day. I was supposed to leave for Japan. And I was to be the supply petty officer in Japan, supplying the ships that were fighting in Korea. And I heard the chief that was in charge of me said, are you really sending Wynn over to Korea, or Japan? And the officer said, yes, that's my intentions. And he says, don't, he'll drink himself to death. And it was true. And I got sent to Edmonton. That's where I spent the Korean War. It's very safe in Edmonton, you know, except if you're the bartender, and I was. And and I almost drank myself to death. And in that time, I met a sweet little girl called Jessie. We'd gone to school together. Matter of fact, Jessie was the brilliant student in high school, and I was following behind her, about 39 behind her, and there was only 40 in the class, so that's got to tell you something. I was into the booze then, and Jessie used to get quite a kick out of me because I disappeared. I had a disappearing act. I'd go to school, register, sit by the window, and as soon as the teacher turned her back, I'd out the window and gone for the day. And I held down a full-time job in between. And it was wartime, and they needed people. As I said, one of the things I really discovered that I really was allergic to alcohol. And all kinds of things happened to me after that. I started, Jessie and I got married, and we moved to the West Coast. And I was on a ship out there called the Stettler. And things started to happen on the Stettler. I had a very good boss. He used to send me down a quart every once in a while, and I was duty-free, and I'd get into it. And I ended up in Vancouver one night, ended up in a hospital. And I was vomiting blood, and I was, hemorrhaging. And I always remember those doctors because they always said, were you drinking much? You know, you're stinking of it, but you can't tell them that you were drinking much. I said, no, I was at the Legion and had 3 beers. No, I'm stinking of rum. So how are you going to be able to tell? But they let it go at that. And that trip I remember very well because they kept giving me enemas every day that I was in there so they could take x-rays. And I got so that I got a sore ass out of it. That's about all I got. And I came back and they said the diagnosis was suffers from acute gastritis. Now, I don't know any alcoholic that drinks at all that doesn't have acute gastritis every morning, as I always did. That was the ship that, and I know I'm telling sailor tales here, but I think it's important that you know just how crazy that some of us are. There's not just a physical thing to it. There's a mental obsession. I knew I shouldn't drink physically. I knew that if I took one drink, I was going to get drunk. And yet I kept thinking it'll be different the next time. And so on this particular ship, Jessie was still in Edmonton, and I was to go and get her. And we just docked. We'd come around from Halifax to the West Coast. And we had just docked, and I was to fly home that night. And this is where I picked up the name the Monkey Man. I was going to go ashore and fly to Edmonton. And I was going ashore, and somebody had bought a monkey down in Panama. And as I went to go ashore, he jumped on my shoulder, wrapped his tail around my neck, and away I went. And I went out to the airport, and I'm all snapped up on that good rum that we had. And I tried to get on the airplane, and they wouldn't let me. They said, you can't get on the airplane with that monkey. And I said, what monkey? You're seeing things. And they didn't believe that. They wouldn't let me on. So I went to the Legion down the street and drank the day away. And I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning in a hotel. I had no idea where it was. I was in this hotel, and sitting on the end of the bed was this bloody monkey, and it was going, and if you think you woke up from a drunk trying to get rid of snakes, try and get rid of a monkey that's been landed illegally in the first place. So I took the monkey back, and then I had to go to the airport, and you know, everybody in the airport was saying, look, there he is, that's the Monkey Man. Okay. And you feel about this big. And I remember I met Jessie in the airport or on the sidewalk in Edmonton. She didn't know I was coming home. And I was shaking so bad. And I said, God, it's cold in Edmonton. I'm just freezing to death. And it was the shakes is what I had. I was It didn't take much to make me sick. And it got worse and worse and worse. And Jesse and I ended up then being posted to Montreal. And it was supposed to be for 2 years. And I arrived down there, and they posted me to be an instructor. Now, one of the things that they said when I was taking my training to be a petty officer was that this man is not recommended to be an instructor, and of course that's the first place they posted me, was to be this instructor, and I was terrified. I'm the guy that in grade one, they asked me to read something and I got up and I peed myself. No, I'm not going to do that ever again. I've got a real fear about that. That's why I like podiums. They're nice. They're very good. You know, you stay away from them. In any event, we got to Montreal and things got worse. I got into all kinds of trouble. I remember chasing my car down the Atwater Drive at about 108 miles an hour. I had a great big Buick, and I got another guy driving my car, rather, and I'm sitting beside him and telling him to go like hell, you know, get down there, and we'll get some. Well, it got worse and worse until finally one night I came home. Jesse by then was so fed up with me, she didn't know what to do. She, liked all good wives that marry alcoholics, thought that she could reform me, and I really didn't want to hurt Jesse. I didn't want to hurt her at all. But the last time drunk I was on, I turned from a happy drunk to a physical one. I was going to throw her down the stairs, and we lived in an upstairs apartment. And I was mean and cruel, and I woke up in the morning. I didn't know what had happened overnight. And Jesse said, Howard, what are you going to do about your drinking? And I had heard about AA through another friend of mine in the Navy who had joined it. He tried to talk to me about it, and I told him to get lost. But anyways, I was faced with this, and I said, well, I guess I'll phone that A&A outfit. So she said, okay, I'll phone him for you. Something like that, anyway. I said, wait. And the guy, of course, on the other end, his name, he was a big Irishman, too. His name was Dan. He was an ex-judge. Defrocked, but he was an ex-judge. And Dan said, well, if he really wants to talk to us about it, he better get his rear end down here and talk to me. So I agreed that I would do it. I always thought I went down by myself. I was always proud that I joined AA all by myself. You know, about 4 years ago or so, Jessie was speaking, and she mentioned that she'd gone down to the AA office with me, and I didn't even remember she went with me. But I do remember what happened when I got there. I remember Dan, all the way down, rather, I was thinking up what I was going to tell this guy down at the AA office. And I was going to tell him about if he had a wife like mine, or if he had a boss like me, line that I got and all the problems that I got, he drank too. And I got in the door and he said, my name is Dan, you must be Howard. And I said, yeah. And he says, well, you can quit lying now, I've heard them all. And I didn't know what the heck to say. I really didn't. And Dan didn't lecture me like most of us don't. We don't lecture. What we do is we tell our story. And Dan told me his story, and he'd been on the skids in New York, and he'd been in Montreal, and he'd been all over the place, but he had sobered up, and he sobered up in AA. And he told me that I don't need to go on with this suffering any longer. And he gave me those 20 questions, you know, the famous 20 questions. And I thought I did well. That's the first test that I ever took that I passed. You know, I had a fear of tests, matter of fact. And I got there anyways. And Dan said, Howard, the best recommendation I can make to you is you go to an AA meeting. And I went to my first AA meeting that night with Jesse, and all the way down it was snowing like mad, and I said, there'd be nobody crazy enough to go out on a night like this to go to a meeting. And she said, well, we'll go anyway. She was pushing a little, just a little, you know. And we got in there, and a guy stuck out his hand, and he said, my name is Jimmy, and I'm an alcoholic. And he said, you must be a new fellow. And I said, yeah, how'd you know that? You know, but it's so hard to tell. You know. And in I went, and I sat down in the back row with him, and he bought me a cup of coffee because he knew I couldn't handle it. I was not just shaken from booze, but I was shaken because I was scared. And if there's anybody new in this room tonight, you'll be scared. It's a big decision. It's a big place to go, and you're scared that somebody's going to find out about you. And anyways, I went to that first meeting, and I hit the bonanza. Eric mentioned it the other night, that Dave B., he was a AA trustee, and he was the first member in the province of Quebec in 1944. And Dave was the speaker for the night. And Dave was a very small man. He wasn't a big man. Kind of had a little bit of palsy in his arms. He used to shake a bit like this, and I thought he was still drinking because he had his arm going until he talked. And, you know, Dave meant a lot to me. He gave me my first big book in the first year that I got in AA. But Dave talked that night, and he talked about feelings. He didn't talk a lot that night about his drinking days. He'd been in, I don't know how many institutions, as I remember. He's number two in the big book, if you want to read Dave's story. And he was a terrific man. Dave was so busy in AA at that time that he had an extra room in the basement where he could hide, and he couldn't hear the telephone, and he couldn't. And he would have to lock himself away because he was so busy in AA. And I listened to him, and he mentioned these feelings, and I knew, I automatically knew that this was the kind of guy that I could listen to. And I did. I listened to him. And that was the last time that I drank, really. It was just the day before that. And it isn't that I didn't want to. I can recall in Montreal going to meetings, and I get tired of them. Because I had a problem. And my problem was I really didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I didn't really believe that I was like you people. I was a little different. Most of the people in Montreal at that time were the people that ended up on the skids, or they'd been in jail, or they had all kinds of problems. And I hadn't gone that far. In fact, they questioned me when I first came in, are you sure you're an alcoholic? After a while, I began to believe it wasn't, you know. So one night I decided, after I got fed up with going to all these meetings, I was going 7 days a week, I decided I was going to go out and get drunk, give it a trial, just have a few, go nightclubbing, I want to live a little. So down I went to my favorite nightclub, and all by my lonesome, I sat down, I ordered a Coke. And I looked around, and this seemed to me that this wasn't the same place that I used to drink in. You know, your thoughts change a little. There was dancing girls in this place, and they'd all aged. You know, without that drink, they'd all aged, the whole bunch. And there was cracks in the wall. I never saw those before either. And they had the nerve to charge me $1.80 for a Coke. And I wasn't going to stay, and I got up and I left, and I never wanted to drink. Another night, I decided I was going to go to drink, and I went to my own meeting. And after the meeting, I was going to drive the guys home. They saw that there was something wrong, and they said, Howie, you'll drive us home. So I loaded them in my little car to drive them home, and somebody stepped in and ran out of gas. I never got drunk. I went home. And I went on in AA. I moved to the West Coast, and I moved all over the place after that. And I went to AA constantly. But I couldn't grasp that thing that people were talking about of serenity. I kept saying to guys, when the hell do you get this serenity you guys are talking about? Because I didn't have any. And what the problem was that I was in an outfit called the Navy, and say 90% of them drank, and I was the sober guy that was sitting next to them, and I had difficulty with that. So I kept thinking, oh, you're different. You're different than them other guys. You never really went that far. You're young. I'm 28 years old when I get in here. So I went on that way for about 5 years. And things had straightened around at home somewhat, but not as good as it should have been. And I had a lot of problems. And finally, I was at my AA meeting one night, and it was a kind of a funny group. We had a real mixed bag of people. The book tells us that, you know, we're a bunch of people that wouldn't normally mix. Well, that's the kind of group I was in. They had everything in there. And this one old guy was a professional gambler. That's all he did. And of course, being, you know, I was higher than he was. He was just a bloody old gambler. And I spoke, and I wasn't really speaking. I was whining. You know how you get when you're really not satisfied with things in life. And I was whining away, and he got up next to speak. And he said, you know, if that fat boy that just spoke, and God, that got my attention right now, I was right mad. What right had he to call me a fat boy, even if I was? If that fat boy would just realize that he hadn't done step one, he might get someplace. And I had 5 years in the program. I'd worked in service. I'd worked in this. I'd worked in that. I did all kinds of things for the good of AA. But I didn't look after myself. And I didn't really accept that I was an alcoholic. So that night in the streets of Victoria, I walked the streets. I was so mad at that guy, I had a number one resentment against this old gambler, Tex. And I decided, after 2 hours of discussion with myself, that Tex was absolutely right. And I haven't wanted to drink since. And I haven't needed a drink since. And that's the kind of fellowship in this program that reaches out to you one simple statement and says, here is the truth. Please accept it. And I did. And I've been around ever since. And a heck of a lot happier. You know, when they first printed the big book, they talked about the first 100 men. We, the first 100 men of this program, and how many we got now? We got over 2 million kicking around in 150 countries of the world. And I've been lucky enough by being in that Navy to visit a lot of those countries and really enjoy different types of fellowship. I can remember being in England, going to a meeting in London, or no, in Portsmouth rather, and they were conducting meetings there. They had never seen a big book. We brought ours along with us, from 7 of us off our ship, and they had never seen a big book, yet they were all sober. They did it different. They don't all do it the same way. The group in Victoria that I used to go to, they call the roll every night. And I didn't realize it the first night that I was there. I didn't realize what they were saying. They said, well, we're going to call it, and they call out the names, and they called out Howard, and I said, yeah. That meant you'd had a drink. I didn't know that. And this was the honesty part of the program where you answered yes, yay or nay. And so they're different. Halifax was different. I spent a year in Fort Churchill. All two of us. You know, it was a big group. And we went to the CO of the base that was loaded with drunks. You could see them all over the place. And we said, we're starting an AA group here, and if you have anybody that you'd like to send over to our hall, we've got this space behind the theater. Send them on over. He says, well, that's fine, but I haven't got any drunks in my division. All right. The COs wouldn't see it either. So. And I went on in the program and did all the things that you're supposed to do in the program to make you keep you sober. And one of them is service. Service in this program is very, very important to all of us. You know, I was on telephone answering not too long ago, and we have a different system in Edmonton than you'd probably do, but our group has to take it the 9th of every month, and we have trouble getting people to take it because they're scared. And, you know, I'm thinking of giving some lessons on how to answer the telephone, because most of the phone calls, if you'll remember, as you get a new person on the line, you know, you get those phone calls, and like Bob Newberg, you get the phone and you say, this is AA, can I help you? You think you have a drinking problem. Oh, how much do you drink? Oh, not much. How much is not much? Just 26 a day. Oh, that's not bad. No, you probably haven't got a problem, and you hang up. Or you'd say, no, go see ADAC. Don't see us and get put into your detox. Yeah. And I think that's wrong. I think that we have changed our part of AA that hurts a lot of people, because they won't always take you in a detox. I have a friend of mine in Victoria that was barred from all the detoxes in BC. Now, he was pretty good. We could probably get him in Alberta if he was around. So we need to get people interested in service. So many don't know what it's all about, and they're scared of it. It's not that they don't want to take telephone answering, or they don't want to go on a 12-step call. They don't know how to do it. And it's up to the people that have been around for a while to train. We need to show them how to do it. And that's what we're doing at any of these functions like this, the roundup. We're showing other people that it works, and it works well. One of the things that I didn't mention tonight was I've got 49 years in the program, but my wife also has 49 years in Al-Anon. And she's been sober longer than I have. I can't understand that. I liked what Dr. Bob had to say about that. For some reason, we alcoholics seem to have the gift of picking out the world's finest women. Why they should be subject to the tortures we inflicted upon them, I can't explain. And I feel the same way. I don't know why, but they have stuck to us. And without Al-Anon, our marriage would have split many years ago. And we've been married, I don't know, 54, did I get that right, Jesse? 54 years, I think. And our two kids, one was 2 years old when I got sober, and the other one was just a baby. And so they don't know anything about a drunken father. They know that I was in AA, and neither one of them has a problem. Now, Sometimes you wonder about that. Do we pass it on to generations? Is this a gene that's in us? It doesn't make any difference. They'll have to handle it anyways. But I think there is something in that, personally. My great-grandfather was a drunk. My uncle was a drunk. And it might go on, but not probably in this next generation. And they're not interested in it. Another thing that Dr. Bob said that I believe a lot of us find out is I came into AA solely for the purpose of sobriety. It has been here through, but it has been through AA that I have found God. And, you know, a lot of us, I say a lot of us, but particularly me, I think in the beginning, I think I was ashamed to believe in God. You know, sailors don't really, unless the ship is sinking, they don't believe in God. Then they swim like mad. I always remember we were in the middle of the ocean and one of my shipmates was a little drunk. And the ship rolled, and he went over the side, and there was man overboard. And we threw him a life buoy, and they turned the ship around, come back, got him, fished him out of the water. His name was Spike Gillis. I shouldn't have given his anonymity away like that. Anyways, he came out of there, and he was singing a song, something about, "Oh, God has saved me now." And I thought, Spike, you never mentioned that before in your life. But I've seen it. I've seen it at sea. I've seen God in his action at sea and saving people's lives and people hollering for God. And I've also seen it in AA. And we don't, all of us don't get saved. Just before I left Edmonton, a very good friend of mine, I looked on her as a very good friend, a nurse, about 40 years old, had her first year in AA and went on a slip and committed suicide. And we wonder, why do those things happen? And sometimes it's because we're so carried away with our own self, we don't pay enough attention to other people, and we lose some unnecessarily. Or there's some judgment goes on, and I think that I have to be very careful with that in this program. As I've learned that, I even caught myself the other day saying, "Look at that nut, got nailed for driving and drinking." I must have drove drunk 400 times, and here I am accusing some guy of being a terrible guy because he was driving and drinking. We can't judge anybody, but we can sure pay attention to each other and try to help each other. How many people are sponsoring people these days? You know, you're given this sobriety, but you've got to give it away. It says that in the book. And I believe this book, by the way, this big book of ours is so close to anything that we talk about our feelings and that everything that's said in there is true. And, Bill didn't get it all just overnight. Bill didn't pick up this stuff by himself. A lot of it came from other people. And I thought, oh, you phony, Bill. The first time that I saw the Serenity Prayer in its full length, anybody ever heard it? It's not just the four verses, but there was a pastor that put this out, and it's when God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference, living one day at a time. What do we talk about in the big book? Enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardships as the pathway to peace, taking as he did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it. Trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will. that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. Amen. A terrific prayer that Bill must have stuck. I think he was pretty good at stealing stuff of other stuff, putting it down. Bill was, you know, was quite a man when you study him. Bill was very human. He was very human. He was just like you and I in a lot of things. He made a lot of mistakes. And I'm not criticizing him, but I met a doctor in Saskatchewan once that had treated Bill. You know what he treated him with? LSD. Now, that's hard to believe, but that's true. And Dr. Hoffer was his name, and he lives in Victoria, if he's still alive. Yeah, is he? And he's a terrific doctor. He was trying to help alcoholics. And I attended one of his lectures in Saskatchewan at that time. I was at the university there. And I was a smoker then. And I always remember him because he came in and he said, "How many in this room are smokers?" We all had our hands up, and he took a count. I wondered what this was all about. The next day he came in, and he had a bag, a little brown bag, and it was full of those nipples that they have for babies. And he said, "This is what you guys really wanted." And that's it. I didn't take kindly to him. You know, he was a terrible man, as far as I was concerned. And he was a vitamin kick guy, too, and my sponsor got a hold of him. My sponsor believed in vitamins. He was always shoving them at me. His name was Murray Black. You might have remembered him. And Murray was always giving me vitamin B and vitamin this and vitamin that. And I didn't believe in them, but, you know, lots of the bags never got home because I'd dump them on the side of the road. But Murray believed in them, and he was a wonderful man. A lot of people in AA that I've met, am I over time or where am I? A lot of the people that sponsored me when I came into AA really got to know me. And they really told me things that nobody else would have told me. One day we were talking about my ego problems. He wanted to talk about them. I didn't. And he said to me, he said, "Howie, you're about as humble as Hitler." And I thought, oh boy, here we go. And he came out with some really priceless stuff that helped me along the line. But he taught me the first Christmas I was in AA, he taught me a real lesson, that how to give. He had another guy that had just got out of jail, and he had me over there, and he had a basement full of broken toys, and he said, "Now put them together." And he had us work on them for night after night after night. And then he said, "Now you're going to deliver them." And I had a little Austin car by then. And I was delivering them all over Point St. Charles to people that were needy. And one of them was a lady that needed, her husband was in jail. And she had an electric stove and it was broken. So Murray had tracked down a gas range and had a brand new one. And he said, "How will you deliver this?" So I had this on the top of my little Austin, and I'm down in Point St. Charles, and that's not a district you want to travel in if you're stealing something. And I was a little worried. And I got down there and I got it up to her place, and she tore a strip off of me like I never had done before. She said, "When you deliver something like that, you better be ready to hook it up." I had no idea how to hook it up. I said, "Yes, sir, yes, ma'am." I got the heck out of there. And then I went to my sponsor and said, "What were you doing to me?" Oh, he says, "I never thought of that." Oh, yeah. So he got one for her. And I learned a real lesson in living in that area, that not living, but working in that area of Point St. Charles. It was primarily an Irish district at one time, so I should have learned something. But my new group that I had in Montreal did not have 6 months sobriety on any member in it. Now you can imagine what kind of a group that was. You know, we read up on our traditions. Each group shall be autonomous, you know. And we decided that we should open a halfway house down in Point St. Charles. So we went to the United Church minister and talked him into it. This other guy, Richie, he's still sober. He lives in B.C. now. He had to leave town. Anyways, we got this space from the United Church minister to have a coffee shop and a place where people could drop in. And it's right down in the skids, and we opened this place, and we needed a guy to run it. So we got somebody off Skid Row that had just sobered up. His name was Jake the Snake. I don't know if you ever met him, Eddie. They had some funny names for some of those guys down there. And Jake, it ran fine for the first month or so, but the old-timers in Montreal kept saying, you guys shouldn't be doing that. You should not do that. We're not in that business. So we didn't have it open too long, and the guy phoned and said, some of these guys are so badly dressed they feel embarrassed when they go to meetings. They don't have any clothes. So we started gathering clothes for them. And the best-dressed drunks in the meetings in Montreal were the ones right out of that halfway house. Because all the rich guys brought their nice suits down and everything, you know. And anyways, it ended up, you know, talking about anonymity, it ended up that we got a phone call one night from the United Church minister, and he says, you got to get down here, you got to get down right away. He said, Jake is drunk, and he's got a bunch of women in. Oh, it was a mess. So we went down, and Richie, this was an ex-military policeman, said, Jake, get out. And Jake said, you can't tell me that I'm the manager here. And Richie drove him in our gentle, kind AA way. Whack, you know. Down he went, and we whacked him out of there and kicked the girls out and closed the place up, and it's never been opened since that I know of. But we learned the hard way. And a lot of us in AA learn the hard way. We break every rule in the book, even when they tell us not to. And that's in our nature. I'm thoroughly convinced that it's in the nature. Somebody mentioned, what are some of the things that you did wrong in AA? Well, that's one of them. But the biggest one that I did wrong in AA was that I was a meeting nut. I went to 7 meetings a week. Now, who was at home looking after the place? Jessie. And she got, I don't know why she didn't leave, but she didn't, thank God. And I wouldn't recommend that to anybody. Yes, AA is important, and AA comes first when you're first sobering up, but if you overdo it, you're going to pay for it. You know, you'll still end up like I did after 5 years with all those meetings. I still did not have that serenity. And I didn't give it to Jesse. And for that, I truly am regretful. I did my 5th step with a woman minister. That's interesting. She was a wonderful woman, and so did Jesse. She did hers with her in Victoria. And she used to go to the prisons, at William Head Prison out at in Victoria, and meet with her boys. They were all AA. And she was a wonderful woman. Unfortunately, a few years later, while we weren't there then, but she was trying to help out some druggie, and he murdered her. And I remember how much that hurt. Why, God, why would this happen to such a beautiful person? And we can get into problems with trying to help people too much. You must also look after your own family first. It's a priority. And I didn't get that message at first. So I would pass that on to you if you want to. If you want to have a life with some good spirit in it, then look after the things close to home. It's a pretty big thing. I had quite a time with the steps. I think I tried every way under the book, and I ended up back using the big book again. And the fears that I listed down were the ones that had bothered me all my life. And I thought I had to get rid of them using my own willpower. And, you know, steps six and seven are not like that at all. It's just not like it says God does it. And that's where I was having the problems. I did not get that thing that the power that in my life comes from God. And I couldn't seem to get that straight. I thought I had to do it on my own willpower. And I struggled for years with that. So I guess that's why I'm still around in AA with 49 years in. Someday I'll get in enough time that I won't have to do all this stuff again. But I don't think so. I love AA. I love the people in AA. I don't know, I sponsor 8 or 9 people. And I think they pick me because I don't bother them too much. Not more than once a week, at least, you know. A lot of them, of course, are what keeps me sober, is because they do the crazy damn things that I did. And I know that I can give the answer. Like, I'm a compulsive buyer. And I have a few people that I sponsor are the same way. I'm the only guy in AA that I know of that went down on Monday and went into a shopping mall and saw this guy playing an electric organ, spent $5,000 and brought it home with me. And I never learned to play a note. Not one bloody note. And I was sober a lot of years. So you're not always, you know, straightened out in the head when you sober up either. I probably am not yet. But anyways, a good friend of mine, Larry Lawler, he's gone now, but Larry always liked to tell the tale about my electric organ. He said, Howie is the only guy he ever met that donated his organs to the Alano Club. And I did. I got a receipt from them for income tax purposes. And they sold it to somebody. So. And I've done a few other ones like that in my sobriety. The first year I was sober, I bought a milk machine, much to Jesse's dismay, that was going to feed us milk at half the cost. It was a powdered milk, and my kids wouldn't even drink it. And I was in debt for another couple or 6 months or a year or something. I was paying for this damn stuff. I got sucked right in, as usual. So I am slightly compulsive with the money. I was at an AA meeting in Montreal one night, and a guy was speaking. It was that Saturday night Eddie Foley's thing that they used to have. Big meeting, a huge meeting, just like this. And this guy was speaking, and he pointed right at me, and he said, "And if you're driving a big Buick and smoking big cigars, you're not sober yet." So I went right out and I sold my Buick and I got a little Austin. Slightly compulsive, just slightly. Impulsive is the word. And I've done things like that continuously through my life. But the beauty of it is I can learn to love and laugh about the damn things that I've done that are so stupid, and I can tell you people about them. I would never have told you before. I was the type of guy that went into a restaurant, dead sober, ordered a cup of coffee, and thought everybody was looking at me and I'd have to leave. You couldn't have got me up to speak in front of a group, no matter what they did. My sponsor sprung it on me the first 2 months I was in. He said, "Howie, Dalhousie University wants a few people to come over and talk about their program. I said, I don't know anything about a program. He says, well, just come along and I'll do all the talking. He lied. He lied like heck. He had it all set up that I was to be the speaker. And I stood up there like a big, well, I won't say the word. I stood up there like a big alcoholic and said something. I don't know what I said. And then he hooked me up in the jails at St. Vincent de Paul Penitentiary. He made me an outside sponsor. Every Sunday morning I was out to the prison. And the first time he went with me and introduced me, and he said, Howie will be here from now on. You know, volunteers, they call them. You volunteer, all right. You either do it. And don't you love the language in AA? I just love it. You know, I just love being called a baby. I get a new guy. I'd like you to meet my new baby. I'm 28 years old. I'm a petty officer in the Navy, and I got more damn pride than Hitler, and he's telling me that. And we do it all the time. And the guys get to love it. They like to be called, somebody wants me. And that's what I found in here. I found fellowship where people really wanted me. And I found, you know, the phone used to just drive Jesse up the wall, I'm sure, but the phone rang constantly after I was in AA. People talking to me, people asking my advice. One guy phoned up and said, Howie, my wife just threw a butcher knife and it stuck in above the door. And I says, Jesus, she must be crazy. He went right back and told her, Howie says you're crazy too, and she's after me now, you know. So you learn early not to make comments about other people's wives. You learn a lot of things like that. And I had one fellow I was sponsoring, and he worked in Fort McMurray. And he was on his third marriage. And she drifted off on drugs and married some other guy that she wasn't even married, split up with this guy yet. And it was a mess. And he used to phone me every night from Fort McMurray to Edmonton. And he would talk away and talk away. And he tells everybody that I used to go over and have dinner and leave the phone on the hook and he'd still be talking. And every once in a while I'd come back and I'd say, yeah. And hang up. And, you know, some of that's not too far-fetched. But that kept him sober. We must have that communication. So we must have the time, in my belief, we must have the time to listen to what people have to say. Whether it's right, wrong, or indifferent, doesn't make any difference. They're getting it out. And, man, that's important. Can you imagine being able to go into a beer parlor and sit down and say, you know, my wife doesn't understand me. And the other guys would say, oh, yeah, we all got that problem, yeah. I'm sure they'd say that. They'd say, get out of here, you rotten. Buy a round or leave. So we don't. So anyways, I've been rattling on here for a long time, and I haven't really said much. So I don't think I got any of the notes that I was supposed to talk about. Let me see. Most believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. That's written in our book. In case you didn't know it, that's what it says. And I believed a lot of that. I'm allergic to alcohol. I love wine. And I was trying to get used to it. And I ended up in the Royal Canadian Navy Hospital on the Pacific Coast with a big rash. And I got in there, and this young doctor diagnosed me as having red measles. And I was in isolation for 2 weeks. Jesse used to come and sit in the hallway and talk to me. And I knew what it was, but I couldn't tell him. It was from drinking red wine. I always broke out with a rash with red wine, you know. And a lot of other people do, too. They even get sores from it if you drink enough of it, you know. So the answer is, of course, you change to white wine. It makes it a lot better. I had the notion once that in changing my drinks before I quit drinking was, I got the notion that the Frenchmen all drink wine with their meals. They don't drink in between, they just drink it with their meals. And if I could learn to do that, I'd be able to drink the same as the rest of them. So I went down and I bought 2 bottles of good wine, and I explained it all to Jesse of what we were going to do. 2 nice wine glasses on the table for the meal. I poured them out. She had 1 sip. I drank both bottles. And I know that if I have 1 drink, I can't stop. And that's all I really need to know about alcohol. I don't need to know what the strength is or what'll do it to me. All I need to know is that if I have 1 drink, I'm on a bender. And I won't stop till I either run out of alcohol or I get so damn sick that I can't drink, or they'll throw me in jail. And that's happened a few times too. But in any event, I haven't had to do that for 49 years, and for that, God, I am grateful. And for that, I'm grateful, Jesse, and for all of you people in this room and all of other people around the world that have helped me. I thank God, and thanks for being here and listening to me. Thank you.